Okay. All right, let me share with you an idea that is well known with regard to Purim. And that is that Purim is often defined as a yontif, which highlights the concept of v'nahafochu. V'nahafochu means Hashem's hand in controlling the world and existence is hidden. And then all of a sudden it just becomes revealed, and what looks like a threat, becomes an expression of salvation. And what looked like was our vulnerability actually became, part of our redemption. And so the idea of Nafochu is specifically bound up with the story of Purim. So I was just working through a few applications of this idea to demonstrate the concept within the actual story of Purim, the Megillah, and let's call it more broadly speaking, and hopefully apply it a little to what hopefully we will experience. So let's have a look at it. Now, it's interesting that when we talk about the phrase v'nahafochu, the phrase really simply means v'nahafoch, and it will be turned. Now, the word who is a word that's near the end of there. It's like in English, it's hard to say v'nahafoch who. What how do you, v'nahafoch, who would normally mean it? So you refer to a situation which is reversed. Something it is reversed. V'nahafochu. But if you ever look at some of the comments of especially among the Chachmei Kabbalah, you start to see that the actual application of this message, that what looks to be completely hidden, camouflaged, is revealed, as if just turned on its head. That the word who is actually part of the actual application. So let's have a look. We'll have a look at it. I'll just quickly do it on Svaria for you. So if we're looking at the famous pasuk in Devarim Lamed Aleph. So we find ourselves in Parashat Vayelech, and there's a really well-known pasuk over there, scary pasuk, which talks about Hashem hiding his face from Klal Yisrael. The Midat Hadin, reigns supreme, and we almost feel Hashem has abandoned us. And so in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yud Chet, so the Pasuk says, V'anuchi Aster Astir Panai, that I, Hashem, will hide my face if Am Yisrael do not comply with the world of mitzvah. Bayomahu, on that day, al kol hara'a asher asa kifana el Elohim acherim, by turning to other gods. That's Dvarim Lamed Aleph Yud Chet. So there, it's interesting. You see the phrase bayomahu, where the word who represents the hiddenness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, when you translate the pasuk very pshat wise, you just on that day. But the interesting how the word who, which represents the hidden face of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is sort of written into the phrase. So this whole pasuk is really the communication about, or the revelation, the prophetic revelation of Purim. Haster is the lashon of hiddenness. Megillat Esther herself. There's all of this concept of Hashem's plan being completely hidden. Prophecy really coming to an end and no longer in proper use. Bottom line is that this is the theme that you find Vanochi Aster Astir Panai Bayomahu, and now it's that day will come where hopefully everything will be turned on its head, revealing the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Aster Astir Panai Bayomahu will become the opposite, Vinafochu. How does that play itself out? So there's another pasuk which we also say often, and if you have a look in Sefer Tehillim, you'll see there's a pasuk Perek Kuflamet Bet, Perek Kuflamet Bet Pasuk Yud Gimel, and there we say as follows: we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has chosen Tzion, Zion, Ivah Lemoshav Lo, as a Ivah is the Lashon of kind of a Lashon Ta'ava, it's an expression of passion, a desire. Kivachar Hashem B'Tzion, Hashem has chosen Israel, Tzion, the Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim, as a Lemoshav Lo, a dwelling place for him. But the word Ivah is a passionate choosing, passionate expression of desire. That's the word Iva, Lemoshav Lo. Of course, when you look at the word Iva, you see the letters that make it up. You see that the word Hu, which represents Hashem's camouflage, if it's turned around, V'nafochu, becomes Iva. So when it comes to kind of the, you know, our relationship with Hashem, specifically with regard to Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, all of that is an interesting, it's a kind of a barometer of where things are holding. Many a time we see our, you know, at least in the eyes of the nation of the world, they see our hold, our claim on Eretz Yisrael is kind of like absent. It's a kind of a, you know, Bayom Ahu, Aster Aster, it's all hidden. Whereas we want to turn around. We want to be nafohu, that the who becomes Iva, becomes a recognized divinely gifted place for Am Yisrael to develop is Eretz Yisrael, etc. Now, there's a very well known concept that is a broad concept describing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to, so to speak, dwell among us. In the words of Chassidus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants a dirah b'tachtonim. You know, Hashem wants a place to dwell amongst us. That's actually a lashon from a Medrash Tanchuma in Parashat Naso, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants a dwelling place in the lower worlds as such. So this idea. It's really interesting how this principle of HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanting to dwell among us, if you look at it, how do you say the word to dwell? You know, so when we talk in halachic terms, for example, when we talk about who has the obligation to put up a mezuzah, we say, is it the owner's responsibility? Is it the chovat hadar, the one who lives there? To live somewhere is ladur, is to live, dar. So a dirah b'tachtonim, the word dar is the root word describing wanting to live amongst people. So it's interesting that what are we hoping to achieve? We want to have HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence close to us. We want Hashem to live among us. That idea is amazingly spelt out where the letter Aleph represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, we have all these gematrias, but it's more than gematria. It's just the Aleph has a yud at the top right-hand corner. It has a yud at the bottom left-hand corner. That represents the spiritual world, the yud of the spiritual world, the yud of the physical world. And the only way we can exist is if a hook connects us one to the other. Otherwise, existence is futile. So the vav, which goes at an angle in between the two yuds, creates the connection between the world of spirituality and the world of physicality. And the yud and vav equal gematria 26 is Shem Havaya, yud hay followed by vav hay. That's the highest spiritual expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his relationship with our physical world. So the letter Aleph represents the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you take the Aleph and you staple it to the concept of Dira B'Tachtonim, you get Adar, the month of Adar is kind of a month which is set aside where the simcha of reconnecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is at its maximum. You know, it's on a greater level even than Yom HaKippurim. You know, Yom Kippur is like Yom Kippurim. This is the theme that becomes very popular within the world of Hasidus Kabbalah with regard to the month of Adar. Now, there's kind of a tie into this when one contemplates that the threat against HaKadosh Baruch Hu's being presence being revealed in our world, and specifically the idea of dwelling among us, this concept is threatened by none other than Amalek. Amalek is the antithesis of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ability to dwell among us. What Amalek does is Amalek sows the seeds of doubt in humanity about the concept of Hashem. You don't see it. It creates a camouflage. It's terror, terrorism. It just comes out there and just perpetrates violence against anybody who adopts HaKadosh Baruch Hu into their system of belief. It's the anti-God force in the world. And it's interesting how this plays itself out. We know that the very first confrontation that we have with Amalek as a people is upon Yetziat Mitzrayim, and we're attacked by Amalek. Well, we know it well. We laid it on Purim morning as the Kriyat HaTorah, the last nine psukim there in Parashat B'Shalach. So there, Moshe Rabbeinu says to Yoshua, look, we have to fight this war on two fronts. We got to fight the war physically, but we got to fight the war spiritually. If Am Yisrael are able to motivate their belief system to mamash have bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we will be physically victorious against Amalek. So you, Yoshua, put together an army and go out against, you know, Gal Hilachayim Amalek. And in order to keep the spiritual war going, I need to represent, or I need to make sure that Am Yisrael can see me and see my hands pointing upwards, as if each time you enter into the fight, you recognize that without recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the mix, you're going to lose the physical war. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes up a mountain, sits on a rock. As we know, he has help to keep his hands up. And the Midrash tells us, V'chiyadav shel Moshe osot milchama. Do you think that Moshe Rabbeinu's hands were waging war? Enechanami, really what was happening is, you know, Ela lomar lach, is the lotion of the Midrash. You know, it comes to tell you, Shekolzman, Sheayu Yisrael, Mistaklim klapay mala, by seeing Moshe Rabbeinu pointing heavenward with his hands, they would look upward and they would realize, Meshabdim et liban laviyem shebashamayim. They would fully commit to be God-fearing people. And at that point in time, we would win the war. At the end of the battle, so we win the battle, but the war unfortunately is not fully vanquished, and Amalek survives to be the eternal enemy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Am Yisrael, throughout history, and will only be defeated the Kates Hayamin when Mashiach comes. But until then, Amalek is the eternal enemy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael. And Hashem, as you know, that last pasuk there, Hashem, so to speak, swears by holding onto his throne. He puts his hand on his throne. He had our case. My hand is the hand of Hashem. He had our case. My hand is on the throne of Hashem. That there's going to be an eternal war. Milchama b'amalek midor dor. You know, from generation to generation. And what that war really represents, how do we fight a war against Amalek in every generation? There are two different opinions in the Midrash. One opinion is, Rabbi Eliezer says that we never accept converts from Amalek. That's kind of the continuous war. Amalek That's it. They can never convert to Yiddishkeit. They barred entrance, you know, and they can never redeem themselves as such. Whereas the Chachamim hold, no, Amalek can convert. Amalek can do tshuva if they want to. And if they do tshuva, we'll accept them. You know, this is the machlokes in the midrash there. It's a machlokes between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. Also have this argument. You know, in the end of the day, the Rambam paskins like the opinion that says that Amalek in theory can do tshuva. You know, we have the Talmud Bavli basically writes that Mibnei Banav Shel Haman Limdu Torah Bibnei Brak. You know, there were grandchildren of Haman that were Rosh Yeshivas. They were teach Magid Hashir in Bnei Brak, you know, teaching Torah, meaning they converted. They did tshuva and they converted. We have all these examples of people converting and doing tshuva, even if they came from Amalek. But bottom line is the ideology of Amalek is really the actual the ideology of Amalek is a threat to all of us throughout history. And the way it's expressed in these psukim is to say, as you probably well know, that if Amalek is around, then it impacts on the revelation of Hashem in our world. No one can see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand. It's camouflaged almost to the point where we think it's absent. And therefore, you know, if Amalek's around, then my throne is missing and my shame, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also diminished. So the word kisei should have been spelt with an aleph. It's just spelt yad al kais. Kais is a chair, a throne, but it's got no aleph. And Hashem's name, Yud Hei, normally followed by Vav Hei, Yad Al Kais Yud Hei, Yad Al Kais Ka, because Baruch Hu's name is not Shalem if Amalek is around. And so, interestingly enough, there's this continuous battle throughout history, Midor Dor. So one could suggest, that midor dor, you know, is spelled chaser, dalet reish, which in the pshat of the pasuk means from generation to generation, means continuously. But perhaps we could interpret what we were saying until now, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, really the ideal situation is Hashem wants to be dar batachtonim, you know, that human beings should admit Hashem into their system and recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu and live accordingly. And yet here, there's a force called Amalek, which is at war with that concept. Midor dor, in order to, it goes out to undermine the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu living among us. And the ability of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to create an Iva Lemoshav Lo, to create a platform, you know, to desire connection with us, is completely undermined by Amalek. So that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Tzion and Echanami and gave it to us for sure. And he wants more than anything. He wants it. He has a desire, Taiva Lemoshav Lo, to live among us. But that's threatened by Amalek, such that the actual ability to do it is compromised. And interestingly enough, the letters that are missing, the Aleph from the word Kisei, and the Vav Hei, the last two letters of Hashem's four-letter name, you see that you have the word, the letters Aleph, Vav Hei, Iva is missing. The threat of Amalek, the existence of Amalek, is an automatic threat against the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will to live among us. And of course, the letters Iva, we turn them around, they create who? A camouflage. Who is third person? Because Baruch is not around. Anyone who, you know, when we talk about Baruch Hu Elokeinu, Baruch Hu is kind of like an expression where HaKadosh Baruch is hidden. It's camouflaged. You don't see Hashem's presence. We have an insight into the preamble in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, just before you talk about the four Arba Banim. We talk about the four children, the four sons, So we have four expressions, and the Mefarshim who link them. So we go Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shanatan Torah L'Amo Yisrael, Baruch Hu. And each of that preamble is like divided into four. And Mefarshim link each one to the characters of the different children. So to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu as HaMakom, you know, you need to be a Chacham, a Rasha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is absent completely from his worldview. So Baruch HaMakom is the Chacham. Baruch Hu, Hashem is camouflaged. He's absent. He's not even there. That's why he's Baruch Hu in the third person. Who is the third person? Rasha, you know, works with that. Baruch Shanatan Torah L'mo Yisrael. If you teach a person Torah, he'll eventually chap what's going on. That's the Tam, who's open to learning. And Shanatan doesn't have the capacity. He's Baruch. Anyway, there's a whole, and the Russia, you know, it could be they're two sides of the same coin. Anyway, this is a Pesach kind of idea. But bottom line is the word who, you know, is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is camouflaged. And we want Venafohu. We want to turn the who into an opportunity to cement Hashem in our universe, specifically that is done through, settling and rebuilding Eretz Yisrael and the Beit HaMikdash, the movement to recognize sovereignty over the entire land of Eretz Yisrael, and thus providing, proof that Kivachar Hashem b'Tzion, and Iva l'Moshav lo, the who becomes Iva, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will, please God, one day, soon, demonstrate that to us. So that is kind of like what V'Nahafochu has begadol. For us to daven for and hope for. So that's the first, let's call it, suggestion. Now, what I do want to share with you is an extension of this V'Nahafochu in the Megillah itself. And now there are obviously some very obvious concepts of V'Nahafochu, but I think the ones that we'll point out some that are not so obvious, and it's based on a chiddush that we find in the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi in a peirush on Megillat Esther called Yosef Lekach. It's an unbelievable peirush. He has tremendous chiddushim. You get an impression of how much respect Gedolim had for his Peirush, which is not really that well studied, to be honest. But whenever the Gaon of Vilna mentions his Peirush, is based on his Chiddushim on the Megillah, or really on the platform of Yosef Lekach, the Malbim as well. They highlight his, they hold him in such high esteem. Anyway, it's a particular Peirush that you get your hands on it. It's quite fascinating. Anyway, let me just demonstrate some of the Chidushim that he shares with us, using to express this principle in the story of Purim itself. In other words, what are we going to show you? We're going to show you that what we could not see as the story was unfolding, we saw a total hidden hand of Hashem, the exact elements that hide HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand that are the greatest threats to us, create the most vulnerable situation for us. They actually become the vehicles of salvation and redemption as well. Like real mamash v'nafuchu. So there are a couple of great examples that you can have a look at. I'll just also mention to you, if you want to see an article on this in English. So again, I mentioned him last week too when we did a chiddush of his, but I recently saw in Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein's Sefer on Purim, he has a chapter on this particular concept of V'Nahafochu. He doesn't he doesn't, you know, he's relating more to the Chiddushim of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi. He doesn't talk on the Ivala Moshav law and that who that that he doesn't relate to. But this is what he brings from the Yosef Lekach. I remember reading it many years ago. Actually, I first got as I got wind of it through reading the Parish of the Gra, you know, who refers to it, and as I mentioned, the Malbim too. So let's have a look at some of the issues that are wonderfully brought out here. Okay, the story of Purim in the Megillah we know well. But we find some of the details interesting. Haman is given advice by his wife and friends that he should take his plan to do away with Mordechai to Achashverosh, you know, in the morning, Baboker, in the morning. That's what they should do. You know, they sit the whole night planning and plotting what they want to do, you know, and they're going to hang Mordechai. So it's interesting that they tell him to wait until the morning. The Megillah tells us that Haman never waited. He was so eager to be the first one to greet Achashverosh after he woke up, that he went to the palace in the middle of the night. And the reason why he did it was, besides being keen, he just did not want, he couldn't wait. He didn't want to take the chance that somebody else would beat him into a discussion with the king. So he's so motivated to take this to Achashverosh. The irony is that becomes his undoing, because he arrives there in the middle of the night. So the Ashgocha put him there just at the right time, that Balailahu Nadidash Natamelech, where the guy's having nightmares and he can't sleep. So Achashverosh's mind is scrambled eggs. He's like, whatever, he feels threatened, and he's got no time to talk to anybody about anything else except, you know, this concept that he may be under threat because he omitted to reward somebody who helped him, who saved him. So the Ashgacha puts it all together, and that's exactly what happened. The first thing that happens is Haman's right there as Achashverosh, you know, comes out of his bedroom looking absolutely haggard because he had no sleep the whole night. He was tormented. And as he comes out in the middle of the night, you know, the first thing he says to Haman, you know, Malasot, what do we do with a person who helped the king, and we need to honor him? And so that's exactly what the first thing that really he gets. So, you know, straight away, Haman's focus, he thinks it's him, right? Straight away, his focus is like literally diverted from his original request. And he can't even discuss it. You know, if he would have come in the morning, you know, he might have, you know, Achashverosh might have had a cup of coffee and relaxed. Okay, Haman, what do you want? You know, Haman's one of his favorite people. So, you know, it happened mamish, you know, right there in the middle of the night when he was totally, when he was, you know, when his whole mind was not at rest. That's a v'nai fochu. So, of course, the v'nai fochu that we know well is when Haman's asked what he should do to, you know, malasot, you know, with the guy that the king wants to honor, Haman thinks it's him. So he says, okay, you've got to, like, you know, take it to town. You've got to mamish dress me up in the royal clothes, put me on the royal steed, you know, put the crown on my head. All these things he ends up having to do for Mordechai. That's the classic v'nai fochu. The other classic is that, of course, Haman builds the gallows on which he wants to hang Mordechai, and he wants to do it so it can be done without delay. And then, of course, he's hanged on that particular set of gallows himself. And ultimately, because he made the gallows so well, so tall, you can see it from the palace. So, you know, that's what he wanted to do. Haman's motivation was that he could enjoy, seeing Mordechai being hung there while he's having a party the following night. You know, but all that happened was, including the public honoring of Mordechai, is that Haman hadn't had the chance to get the gallows down because he was involved in all of this. And so the gallows were there in view of everybody, so that when Esther uncovers who Haman really is, Charvona walks into the room and says, you know, hey, look at these gallows. You know, these gallows, Haman erected them in order to hang Mordechai. You know, this is the story. And of course, the king takes one look at the gallows after, you know, being revealed to exactly what Haman's going to do. And he says, Tulu, I love, you know, hang him on it. So those are the more well-known benafochus that we find. But the most beautiful chiddush that I appreciated out of this Rabbi Ezer Ashkenazi's perush, I thought this next chiddush was just fascinating. I'd never ever taken note of it, how this thing comes together. The chiddush that he teaches us is this. He says, if we go back to the beginning of the story, Vashti refuses to appear before Ahasuerus. What to do with Vashti? So they sit around this advisory table with all of his officers and advisors, and Memuchan recommends that Ahasuerus execute Vashti. So the Gemara Masechet Megillah Yudbet Amud Bet, the Gemara that tells us that Memuchan is Haman. You know, his name is sort of hidden in that phrase because his Muchan Lepuranut is, you know, he's essentially designated for punishment. So, but Memuchan is the one, Haman is the one that recommends that Vashti be executed. Now, of course, you see the Benafochu straight away that by killing Vashti, you open up the opportunity for Esther, you know, to take her place. That's also well known. But what I found a fascinating chiddush is that Memuchan's words state as follows. Imar HaMelech Tov, you know, if the king sees fit to do this, if it pleases the king, Yaitzei Dvar Malchut Milfanav, an edict should go out. V'yikatev betatei parasu madai velo yavor. You should make known the laws of the empire, paras and madai, that nobody should be able to violate them. That Vashti not appear before King Ahasuerus. Now, normally I interpreted that the law would go out, and the law would be such that you know, women have to know their place. Exactly what Haman was saying. That's, you know, that's at the end of Perek Aleph there. But the way that Yosef Lekach interprets this, he says that no, the psukim say that there's a strange lawyer. Asher lo tavo vashti lifnei ha-melech Ahasuerosh. It's a weird pasuk if you think about it. It's one of that Vashti not appear before the king is an actual law, not as a result of Vashti not appearing before the king. That's how I normally understood it. But no, Vashti not appear. Asher lo tavo vashti lifnei ha-melech Ahasuerosh seems as one of the laws. So how does this kind of thing get in? What does this law mean? So he interprets as follows. He says like this. He says, what Haman or Memuchan was looking to achieve and suggest to the king is that Haman is actually proposing a new type of law. The key phrase is what we call Dvar Malchut. It's normally translated as a royal edict. You know, when we say Imar HaMelech Tov Yaitzei Dvar Malchut Milfanav, we interpret there should be like an edict going out to the people, a law. So yeah, Rabbi Ezer Ashkenazi says something brilliant. He says, it's not just a law like every other law. It's a whole new type of law. It's Dvar Malchus. It's coming. It's something which is a new type of royal edict. You know, not every edict is a royal edict. What does he think is the difference? So he says, well, look, he says, the image that the Megillah draws for us is that there's Ahasuerus sitting around taking advice from his wise men, Chachamim Yodei Ha'itim and others. You know, the Choshuva people of the realm, you know, these knights of the round table, they're sitting with him, giving him advice. Now, did he inherit the system from those that he took over from? We know Ahasuerus usurped power. Yeah, he's not royalty. He comes in, you know, as a coup. Did he inherit the system? Does he want to get rid of it? Would he prefer it not be there? But he can't get rid of it. He's got to, like, play his cards right. This is a possibility of how to understand where Ahasuerus is holding. The theory is that Ahasuerus would like nothing more than to be a dictator. But he hasn't yet got the opportunity to kind of, like, he's got to do it slowly because there'll be rebellion against him. He's got to be careful. What Haman actually shows his brilliance by perceiving that Ahasuerus, you know, is such a person who cannot wait to be a dictator. And Haman will gain Ahasuerus' support if he initiates a new system. A new system where a new type of royal law, royal decree. Haman opens a Pandora's box here. He opens the Petach. He gives Ahasuerus an opening. And he says to him, he says, all other laws until now have been subject to the advice and influence of, you know, of the seven nobles who are present around the table. Your majesty, don't make any decisions on your own without consultation. I'm suggesting a new type of law. And that new type of law is called Dvar Malchut, which means that any issue that relates directly to you, your majesty, can be decided upon by you alone. That's Dvar Malchut. He created the concept of Dvar Malchut, that anything that is directly related to you, you can decide without consultation. Now we understand what the pasuk says at the end. At the end of the perek, you know, Vayitav Adavar b'nei HaMelech. Ahasuerus couldn't have been happier. You know, that's why it was so good in his eyes. You know, because it did so much to help. Number one, it gave him an ability to deal with Vashti without having anybody on his case. He could do whatever he wanted with Vashti. That's what it meant. That's what it meant in the Megillah, Asherot Tavo Vashti. You know, that Vashti no longer will exist in front of the Melech. She'll be killed. Now, normally he'd have to go and get advice. You know, can't pass a law like this without having a buy-in from the people. So now Memuchan offers him a way out of his predicament with Vashti. But more than that, he gives him complete power that he never had before. You know? So this is something that is unique to the story. And so Haman actually created this concept of Dvar Malchut. The perek bet ends. And perek gimel begins, Achar advarim ha'ele, gidal ha'melech Ahasuerus et Haman. Now, what's advarim ha'ele after these things? Well, perek bet ends with Mordechai's discovery of the assassination plot by Bigtan Vateresh. Mordechai tells Esther then relays it to Ahasuerus. They arrest Bigtan Vateresh. And now what do you do with Bigtan Vateresh? Well, this plot has everything to do with Achashverosh. He's got now Dvar Malchut has been passed, and he can decide exactly what to do. So he comes along and he decides that I'm going to kill him. So he executes them, and he does it with the authority of the Dvar Malchut. And now, who gave him the ability to do that? Haman. And therefore, Acharat Varima Eile, Gidal Hamelech Achashverosh et Haman. Because without it, how does the Perek follow through? You know, Bigtan and Teresh wanted to assassinate Achashverosh. Mordechai discovers. Mordechai tells Esther. Esther tells Achashverosh. They kill Bigtan and Teresh. Acharat Varima Eile, Gidal Hamelech Achashverosh et Haman. What's Haman's promotion got to do with the fact that Bigtan and Teresh were discovered and neutralized? Nothing. But with this chiddush, that how were they neutralized? Through the king. The king didn't have to ask anybody. How? Because of Dvar Malchut. Who invented Dvar Malchut? Haman. The king recognizes. Haman probably tells him. And therefore, because of the Dvar Malchut, which allowed him to kill Bigtan and Teresh without asking anybody, that's Haman's gift to him. Therefore, that's how he interprets what, you know, what goes on over here. Now, what's, you know, in extension to this, Haman is not just giving Dvar Malchut to the king, Stamazoi, right? But and Haman's got a strategy. Haman realizes that he has the power to manipulate the king. He knows where his sweet spots are. He knows where his raw nerves are. All he has to do is get the king on his own. So we're suggesting here that Haman, Memuchan's Dvar Malchut initiative was so that Haman could control the king. You know, if Haman wanted to, perpetrate a genocide against Am Yisrael, He runs the risk of having all the other wise men say, what are you doing? Don't be stupid. We're trying to create an empire that will last, not one that gets into a war. Haman has to avoid debate on this issue. So he's going to sideline all the wise men so that he creates a Dvar Malchus. If I get a Dvar Malchut where the king is on his own, I can manipulate the king. And so, therefore, when Haman wants to actually sign and seal the decree against Am Yisrael, what does he say? He has to package the genocide as being a decision that can be made only by the king, without any consultation with anybody, because it's a Dvar Malchut issue. But how's Am Yisrael's existence a Dvar Malchut issue? So look what the Pasuk says. Haman comes to Achashverosh and says, Yeshno Am Echad. Right? Mefuzaru Meforad. They're well placed all over the empire. V'datehem shonot mikolam. V'datei hamelech einam osim. It's an affront against the king. What he's saying is, it's a Dvar Malchut issue, and we can solve this now. Straight away, just give me the right. We'll write it and sign and seal it in a minute. It's because of the Dvar Malchut initiative that the Jews are in the most vulnerable position. You know, this Dvar Malchut is a threat like none other to Am Yisrael. That's the kind of greatest, the vehicle of threat is this Dvar Malchut. Because Haman's got Achashverosh exactly where he wants him, in the palm of his hand, and he can manipulate him, which he does. And so having this Dvar Malchut, convincing the king that it's the Dvar Malchut problem, he doesn't have to worry about anybody else. And this is exactly what Haman uses to his advantage. So when we look at the story through these lenses, Dvar Malchut is the most dangerous vehicle that we are looking at. Now, how does the story unravel? This concept of Dvar Malchut, Benafochu, actually is the vehicle of the salvation of Klal Yisrael. This concept of Dvar Malchut, which at first glance through the story is the greatest threat to us, because through that vehicle, the genocidal plot can be cemented. You'll see now through the eyes of the Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi how he interprets the psukim in the Megillah to show you the Vanafochu of the story. So what does he say? He says like this. He says, again, Haman's at the second Suda, the second feast with Esther and Achashverosh. Esther then reveals who Haman is. And as a result of unmasking Haman, the king can make, the king is so to speak, spoken to in such language that Haman's preoccupation with destroying Mordechai and Am Yisrael is a Dvar Malchus issue, such that Achashverosh can decide on the spot what to do to sort it out. So that's what you see in the Pasuk. Charvona comes along and says, hey, Gami Naya Eitz Asher Asa Haman LeMordechai, that set of gallows that he put up, Asher Diber Tov Al HaMelech, you know, he wants to destroy Mordechai. That's the whole thing over here. He wants to destroy Mordechai, who did Tov Al HaMelech. That's a Dvar Malchus. Your Majesty, you can sort this out in 1 second. You know, and the gallows is there. Or maybe Beit Haman Gavua Chamishim Ama. The king is, of course, furious. He taka einachanami. It's a Dvar Malchus. Vayomer HaMelech, tlu alav. You know, hang him. That's kind of the, you know, didn't have to consult with anybody. You know, in theory, Haman could have appealed to some of his friends in government, could have bought them off. Maybe, you know, just to have a stay of execution. All right, he'll spend a bit of time in jail. And maybe he can convince people that when he gets out, he'll find grace, favor in the king's eyes again. He'll buy them off. But this way, it's Dvar Malchus. The only guy that has to make the decision is Achashverosh, Vayomer HaMelech, Tlu Alav, hang the guy. But the most majestic of this of the Chidushim on this Dvar Malchus is this part here. What happens? And that is that Rabbi Ashkenazi suggests a Chidush Dika interpretation of this pasuk, of two psukim. We understand that a letter was sent out decreeing the destruction of the Jewish people. After Achashverosh gave permission and gave Haman his signet ring to sign it, what was written on the letter, you know, Vayikatev, Kechol Asher Tziva Haman, El Achashdar Pnei HaMelech, Vela Pachot, Vela, you know, Senderat Medina Umedina, Sariam Baam. What was written in there? Lashmid, Larog, Labeid, Kol HaYehudim, to destroy all of Am Yisrael. On the 13th of Adar. That's what we understand went out in this letter. However, the Yosef Lekach points out that there's another pasuk, the next pasuk, in Perek Gimel. The next pasuk says, Pachegen HaKetav, you know, Pachegen are the copies of the letters. Linatain dat b'chol medina u'medina, they were to be delivered across the empire to each country or town or whatever you want to call it. Galui lechol ha'amim, you know, revealing to everybody, liot atidim layom hazeh, to be prepared for that day. Now, until I saw this chiddush, to me the pasuk was simply telling us that the genocidal decree that was signed by Ahasuerus was communicated to everybody in the empire. Yeah, Rabbi Ashkenazi points out that he says that pasuk Yud Bet and Yud Gimel, which talk about the letter, that letter has the information in it, Lashmid, Larog, Labed on the 13th of Adar. But he said that pasuk Yudalad, which says that Pacheg and Akitav, does not have any of those details in it. He interprets that there are two letters that are sent out simultaneously. Two letters. One to the officers and another to the public. And the letter that went out to the public had no details in it. It just said, Liot Ha'amim, Liot Atidim La'yom Hazeh. Just be ready for something unique on that day. Just take off work, cancel whatever holidays you have. Just be prepared, have your boots on, you're ready to go. There's going to be something that's really important. But he wants to keep it secret because he doesn't want anybody to undermine his program. See, so he'll only let the details out on the day. On the day. Lahavdil. Lahavdil. The theories that's what happened to with Hamas, you know what I mean? They had the plan, they kept the plan secret. Only on the day they released it. No, they didn't want it to get anywhere. No intelligence should pick it up. That's what Haman did over here as well. Two letters. One to the officers who needed to know what to be done. They knew the details. Then to the Amcha, they got just to be prepared. That was the story. Now, okay, Mordechai discovers what the actual plot, and he tells Esther about it. Now, as a result of Haman sending out two letters, one with a decree on it signed by the Melech, one with a, so to speak, cryptic message saying, people of Shushan or people of Ahasuerus' empire, the Persian Empire, Liot Atidim La'Yom Hazeh, just be ready to go on this day. Something unique is going to happen. What kind of a hashgacha is that? That kind of a letter went out. He has the chiddush. As soon as Haman was exposed, Esther begged Ahasuerus to have mercy on Klal Yisrael. Ahasuerus said, okay, but a decree that is signed by the seal of the king can't be revoked. Meshugas, that's what it is, right? So Esther, through the eyes of the Rabbi Elazar Ashkenazi, says to Ahasuerus, no problem. No problem. We won't have a decree with the seal of the king that will be revoked. Won't have it. We've got a decree that's already been sent out. There's a blank piece of paper. The paper says, everybody be ready. We're ready for something. We just fill in the blank. We send out a letter saying, by the way, that public decree that had no details, he has the details. You know what the details are? The Jews can defend themselves. That's the detail. So it's already all there, ready for Mordechai and Esther to fill in the gap. And that way, that letter was ready to go with the seal of Ahasuerus, allowing the Jews to defend themselves and to exact vengeance from their enemies. That's what is described in Perek Chet of the Megillah. So it turns out that Haman prepared the paperwork for the decree that would allow the Jews to defend themselves. All Mordechai and Esther had to do was fill in the blank. That is v'nafoch. That is that. That's the real v'nafoch. So an unbelievable chiddush as to how to understand the actual pshat of the Megillah and the story the way he interprets it. Okay, we will say wish you a good week. I hope you guys are well, and we will Bezrat Hashem meet next week, and I guess maybe some more Purim, unless you want Parsha, whatever you want. Okay.
Well, Rib Davy, thank you.